We are midway through our theme of why do we do Lent? We do Lent to get closer to Jesus, to shine a light on how to find Jesus in the desert, in the dark parts of our world and of our soul. Jesus himself knew that in order to really understand his ministry, he had to go out into the desert, and his own temptation took place 40 days and 40 nights in the desert. So Lent is a good time to ask the question, how do you find God when you're tired or worn out or run down? Where do you find God? Not just in the high times and in the good times, but in the times when you're spinning your wheels or stuck. But before we get to the stuck and spinning wheels and the desert times, I want to take your memory back to some very good times, some very undesert-like places, locations, and scenes in your memory. I want you to consider, where and when were your most memorable meals? Think of all the amazing places that you've grabbed a bite to eat. Some have been remarkable places where you were with family and friends, and some have been less elegant. You've grabbed food to eat on the go, on the run, perhaps in Chicago or at a rest stop on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. You've eaten perched on the corner of a picnic bench at the family reunion and at a very fine table at the wedding of your son. You've eaten at a buffet, all you can eat on a bus trip, or gone out to a five-star hotel for your anniversary. If you're like me, though, you'll find that your favorite meals, the menu wasn't all that important. Was less about the food that you ate, but the company that you were with. For example, I can't tell you what I ate at an Amish farmhouse or at a British pub or in the shadow of Martin Luther's church in Wittenberg, Germany, but I know exactly who was there with me. And I know the very room. I could GPS it for you. I could pinpoint it to the very spot within like 5 feet. I know exactly where I've eaten my favorite meals. At the kids' table. Thanksgiving and Christmas, 18 North 4th Street, Allegheny, New York, at my grandparents' house. I could pinpoint it to you to an almost exact location. The greatest feasts. The greatest meals of my life. Feasts and banquets are very important in the Bible as well. Primarily because, one, you really can only feast in safety and security. You can eat if you're on the run, but you don't have a feast on the battlefield or if you're running from authorities. You don't feast the first night that you move into a new house, do you? I haven't. Anytime I've ever moved, when you're the first night in a new house, you're lucky if you can find the Lucky Charms and a paper bowl and maybe some milk or some creamer that you pour in there because you can't eat it dry, right? And you're lucky if you can find the food that's packed away. The silverware is boxed away. And so are the bowls. But it's not only safety that makes a feast, but also with whom you feast. You usually don't feast with total strangers. You might, not know a lot of people, but usually you have some connection to the people that are there. You feast at weddings or birthdays. You're invited over to celebrate something, someone's retirement party. And who is around the table is as important as safety and security. And the Bible is full of feasting in safety, where God is eating with his children, the Israelites, where Jesus is at the head of the table and the disciples make the guest list. But it happens hundreds of years before Jesus even shows up on the scene. Hundreds of years before Jesus spoke the parable of the wedding banquet, the Jewish people were eating the Passover feast to remember that God had rescued them from their bitter and cruel slavery in Egypt. And it is a tradition, Passover feasting, that our Jewish brothers and sisters have celebrated uninterrupted to the present day. David, in the 23rd Psalm, speaks of the shepherd God preparing a table before me in the presence of mine enemies, that God is even able to override that need for safety and security. Even when David feels surrounded by people of ill will, God makes sure that he's able to eat. Preparest a table in front of me. As we said with the children, Jesus celebrated the wedding feast at Cana in the first of his miracles. The book of Revelation says that heaven will be like a feast, a wedding feast. In Revelation chapter 19, verse 9, it says that the marriage supper of the Lamb is what heaven will be like. And then Jesus himself says something really interesting in Revelation chapter 3, verse 20. You're familiar with this verse. Jesus says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." And you've all seen the picture, the Salmon picture, the Warner Salmon picture. I think we probably have one here in the church of Jesus knocking on the door, right? And people say, "Oh, that's Jesus knocking on the door of your heart, and you've got to let him in," right? But do you remember the second part of that verse? "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with that person, and they with me." Fascinating. Jesus says he'll come in and eat with you and with me. It's in this context, then, heaven as an eternal banquet, where we are as safe as we were at the kids' table in your memory, surrounded by love. Now, wait. Some families, that wasn't their experience. Some families didn't feel safe at the kids' table. Some families fought at Thanksgiving. Some families never had peace at the kids' table, but rather abuse or bullying or belittling. But yes, here in Matthew 22, the host of the banquet, the king, can provide eternal security, food enough for all. Because the king is having a wedding banquet for his son. The king, of course, in the parable is God, the Father. His son, of course, Jesus Christ, the Messiah. And in the parable, the guests refuse to come. In the face of such a great present of peace on earth, goodwill to all people, these guests decide, you know what, it's really not worth it. We'll refuse the invitation, and it's almost an incredible refusal. It's outrageous to think that the king is offering this feast where you will be eternally secure and you will always have enough to eat and you will never have to worry again about where you are located or safety or security, that God invites you and people turn him down. It's outrageous. Until I realize that I do it every day. That God invites me to forgive my past, and I don't. That God invites me to share what I have because it was never really mine to begin with. I didn't plant the grain, nor did I milk the cow for my cereal this morning. I got it as a gift. Sure, I paid for the cornflakes, but I got it as a gift. I didn't follow every step through the process. If you want to take it all the way back, it's a gift because God gives us the grain, and God gives us this beautiful creation. And most of the time, when I'm eating, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about what a miracle it is that this food got to this point to make it to my plate. All the work and the labor, all the people who were part of the chain, from the farmer to the day laborer who picked it to the trucker to the stock boy. It's a miracle of sorts. And these guests are too busy making a career or feathering their nest or keeping up with the Joneses to accept the call to come. They say, "Nope, not interested. I got other things planned." And the king is furious. The king wipes out those guests and starts all over. And he says, I'm going to invite, he instructs the servants to go out and invite the good and the bad, the rich and the poor, the sinner or the saint. They all get a chance to show up to God's banquet hall. And so the feast goes on anyway, and the hall is filled with guests. And then we think, great, that's more like it. That's more like the banquets from the Old Testament, from the book of Isaiah, where multitudes stream towards the holy mountain of God, living in peace, where they will beat their swords into plowshares. People will no longer raise up hands in anger or violence against one another. And I finally feel like, oh, great, that's a good story. Which would be fine if that was where the parable ended. But it doesn't. It doesn't end there. The king makes his rounds. He goes to visit his guests. He says to them, he says, thank you for coming. He shakes hands with some people. He sees some other folks. He gives them a kiss on the cheek. And everything is wonderful until the king encounters one guy that he invited who doesn't have the proper wedding robe. It's a puzzling detail. At first blush, it's really a head scratcher. God invited this person to the feast. How come he's now threatening to kick him out? Well, it is a puzzling detail until you remember that wedding robes are symbols in the New Testament and throughout the Bible of new life. The people who are in heaven in the book of Revelation are wearing robes that are white that have been presented to them by Christ because they've been faithful throughout all their life and were faithful even in their moments of dying and death. The very early church, the first 200 years after Jesus' death and resurrection and ascension, the first 200 years of the church or so, when you were baptized, you were presented with a new robe to wear. When you were about to be baptized, you were taken back into a little antechamber off to the side of the church. You were outfitted with a new white robe. You took your street clothes off and you entered into the sanctuary with a brand new spanking white robe, signifying that you were going to turn off that old chapter of your life. Turn off those things that needed repentance. Turn off that pride. Turn off that sinfulness. And you are going to put on Jesus and go forth into something new in your life. That helps us understand the parable a little bit, because this man without a wedding robe accepts the invitation, but he does not want to change. He wants to eat the roast duck, and he wants to have the stuffing, and he wants to have the salad with blue cheese, but he does not want to forgive his neighbor. He doesn't care too much about the host of the meal, whether it's given by God or whether it's given by somebody else. He just likes the gifts that he's received. In other words, halfway measures are not enough to enter into God's kingdom. This man is not a gracious guest. He turns up at the banquet, he accepts the invitation, but when he shows up at the hall of heaven, he says, you know, these drapes, I'm not really sure, God, that these drapes are appropriate for heaven. These drapes kind of stink. Or he doesn't accept or doesn't like his accommodations very well. You know, in the Gospel of John, it says that there are many rooms in my Father's house, and I'm going to prepare a place for you. This guy has the nerve, he has the rudeness to say, you know what, God, I'm not really happy with where my room is placed. I'd like to be closer to the golf course. Or I'd like to not walk so far to get to the dining hall. Or do I really have to live next to them? I couldn't stand them in life. And now they're my next door neighbors for eternity. I hate it here. That's why he gets kicked out. Because he wants the gifts, but he doesn't want to change. You've seen ungracious guests. Perhaps you've even been one. Part of me certainly has. Part of my personality, unfortunately, is to be like this man. You've seen it. Think back to Think back to a wedding you've been to. I'm sure this has happened. This happens at every wedding I've ever been to. When the reception happens, somebody grumbles that the bride and groom are taking too long to get back from taking their pictures. Why did they go all the way over there and keep us waiting? I'm really hungry. And you know what? These cookies from the cookie table are just not doing it for me. I want to get to the main event. That's what this guy does. He's an ungracious guest. He's an ungracious guest. It's enough to be thankful that you're invited. This man wants to sup at the table without prayer, without forgiveness, without changing his life in any way, and he presumes to tell the host, God the Father, what the afterlife is going to be like. It's got to be on my terms, or should be on my terms, or nothing. And God does not accept that. The wedding guest without a gown takes and takes and takes. The food is good, the view is okay, but don't ask me, God, to change. Don't ask me to change, God, by getting close to you, by sharing my bread with another person who has less. Don't ask me, God, to open your word and to study what you actually say. I'll just take it on faith that I'm already pretty good and I already know what you have to say to me. It's rather sad, really. For the king offers us rich food beyond measure. The king offers us a kid's table piled high with food, and you are surrounded with all the friends and family that you love, both those here and now in this moment and those who have passed on. They're there waiting for you. It's rather sad when we say, you know what, it's too hard to change. It's rather sad that for some people, for some parts of my own soul, that the cost of one wedding robe is still too high to say yes to God and no to sin and to the past. Amen.